Good morning. It's Friday, July 11th. I'm Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, Trump goes hot and cold on Putin, why ICE agents are wearing masks, and the dramatic upset that put the young American Amanda Anisimova in the Wimbledon final. But first, to Texas. Today, President Trump is expected to visit the site of the deadly floods that barreled through the Hill Country last week. But so far, the leader of FEMA, David Richardson, has been laying low. He's made no public appearances or statements since the disaster. The federal response has largely been led by Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. And FEMA generally is facing increased scrutiny over the role it played in the Hill Country's preparedness for a disaster of this size. Nearly a decade ago, officials in Kerr County, which was hit hardest by last week's floods, started asking FEMA for money to fund a more robust flood warning system, including upgraded water level sensors. It would have cost just under $1 million, but the office that manages Texas's FEMA grants turned Kerr County down twice. Across the state, there was just more demand for federal funds than money available. And Kerr determined state-level money wouldn't make a dent in what they needed, so the project was abandoned. What happened in Kerr County isn't unique. Long before this disaster struck Texas, communities nationwide have struggled to get federal funds to prepare for natural disasters. In fact, in his first term, Trump supported a bill that sought to fill that gap, launching a FEMA program in 2018 called Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities, or BRIC for short. Expanded under Biden, BRIC eventually set aside about $4.5 billion for local hazard mitigation projects. And Zach Coleman, a climate and energy reporter for Politico, told us that money made a real difference.
There were processes that were working for some people. There were people who were getting disaster relief spending and emergency payments, and a lot of that got gummed up as the administration started to pull resources back.
Trump shut down the BRIC program earlier this year in April as part of his administration's broader efforts to slash federal spending. He's also threatened to shut FEMA down entirely and shift its responsibilities to the states.
There are only so many states that could really take this on themselves. And it's maybe the ones that are more used to dealing with disasters, but counterintuitively, it also might make those the least likely to be able to handle this because they're the ones who absorb billions of dollars in damage. And then if you think about smaller states that might get hit with the disaster that they're not expecting, what do those states then do? How have they budgeted to even begin this kind of cleanup process and emergency management process? How can these states make up the difference? And I think the really short answer is they can't.
When federal funding for local disaster mitigation was slashed, a city in Maryland on the Chesapeake Bay lost $36 million in funding for flood protections. In Oklahoma, officials in Stillwater lost nearly $20 million to improve drainage systems. And in Scranton, Pennsylvania, officials lost millions of dollars that were supposed to help demolish homes that were irreparably damaged by flash floods. Instead, most of the BRIC funding to help prevent disasters has now been allocated for FEMA to use for what comes after, the recovery. And experts in preparedness say the cuts to hazard mitigation will put local communities in a precarious position, especially as climate change intensifies many of these natural disasters.
This is not a good mix. This is not the trend you want to be heading down, where you have fewer federal resources, more disasters, and more people in the line of fire of those disasters.
If Trump does get rid of FEMA, Coleman says the effects of that decision will ripple across federal and local government alike.
There's any number of things that we're going to have to start to manage for in a broad, holistic way that FEMA has had a huge hand on in its decades of existence, and I wonder about the nation's ability to handle these broad systemic risks.
Let's turn now to Russia's war with Ukraine and the United States' involvement. There's been a lot of movement in recent days. Yesterday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Rubio said that the U.S. and Russia had exchanged new ideas for peace talks in Ukraine, but didn't elaborate further. He did add that President Trump has been disappointed and frustrated by what he has seen as a lack of flexibility on the part of Russia. That's putting it mildly, based on how Trump himself spoke about Putin during a recent cabinet meeting.
We get a lot of bullshit thrown at us by Putin, for you want to know the truth. He's very nice all the time, but it turns out to be meaningless.
The posture we're seeing from Trump now is a long way away from his treatment of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office back in February. At the time, Trump refused to blame Putin for the war. But more recently, Trump suggested Putin might be, quote, tapping us along. And after what looked like a brief pause on U.S. munitions for Ukraine, Trump resumed them this week without explanation. Matthew Luxmore is a foreign correspondent with The Wall Street Journal who's been reporting on the dynamic between Putin and Trump.
It seems that Trump, who really wanted to strike a peace deal in Ukraine, is beginning to realize what I think a lot of people have realized for quite a while now, definitely Ukrainians included, which is that Putin is not interested in an end to this war that doesn't include Ukraine's capitulation, or essentially Ukraine handing over everything that Russia is demanding.
In recent weeks, Russia has attempted to seize more territory and amped up aerial attacks in Ukraine, even as a Putin spokesperson told the BBC that they were hopeful to get diplomatic talks back on track with the Trump administration. For a long time, the relationship between Putin and Trump has been of mutual admiration, with both men publicly praising the other. So Trump's open contempt for Putin's behavior lately is quite a turn. But Luxmore told us that the reason the Kremlin isn't responding publicly to Trump in the same aggressive tone is because Trump has been known to change his mind often.
They've seen the way that Trump's line on Russia has changed. And I think they're waiting to see whether this is a kind of new hardened U.S. policy that is critical of Russia and more supportive of Ukraine, or whether in the space of the next 2 weeks, Trump may once again come around to seeing Russia as the side that wants to strike some kind of peace deal and Ukraine as a side that is not doing things conducive to peace.
Luxmore said there are at least two material things that Trump could do that would signal that this is a change that goes beyond just words. One is signing legislation imposing sanctions on Russia, something that Trump said he is considering.
We don't exactly know the details of what those will include, but it could be things targeting Russia's energy sector, which could be quite debilitating and quite damaging for Russia's economy, which is very reliant on oil revenues and gas revenues.
The other would be the approval of a new missile system for Ukraine that the White House is also reportedly considering at the moment. The war, meanwhile, goes on. Russia has in recent days targeted Ukrainian cities with a barrage of drone strikes, among the worst, Ukraine's foreign minister said, since the invasion first began more than 3 years ago. Now to immigration and the ongoing tensions from immigration raids. Clashes broke out between ICE officials and protesters in California yesterday when masked agents arrived at farms in Ventura County, not far from L.A. Agents reportedly deployed tear gas to deter the crowds and detained dozens of farm workers, according to local news outlet KTLA. The station posted one video, later shared by California Governor Gavin Newsom, of people fleeing tear gas. In it, you can hear a young boy who was separated from his mother.
Do not panic! Do not run! Do not run! Stay calm!
They took your mom?
You can see the boy nodding to the reporter's question, clearly distressed. In recent weeks, immigration enforcement efforts like these have left cities on edge as armed federal agents sweep through, detaining people they suspect of violating immigration laws. Much of that effort has focused on Los Angeles, where federal authorities say they've arrested close to 2,800 people since raids started in June. And Los Angeles Times reporter Jenny Jarvie told us the tactics they have used have sparked widespread fear among residents.
They're wearing neck gaiters, they're wearing balaclavas. In some cases, they're wearing full military gear and helmets, jumping out of unmarked vans and snatching people off the streets in a way that is sort of sowing fear and panic across communities. Many people think it's a public safety threat.
There is no federal policy that prohibits federal agents from wearing masks that cover most of their face. Attorney General Pam Bondi suggested at a Senate subcommittee hearing last week that she was unaware plain-clothed agents have been wearing masks during arrests. But she and other officials, including the acting director of ICE, have defended the tactic, saying it can help keep officers safe in the field.
They say that due to a combination of factors, a sort of very heightened time of political discord, due to new facial recognition technology and an increased threat on doxing of social media, the job is just much more difficult and dangerous for agents in the field.
And the Department of Homeland Security says agents on enforcement operations have seen an exponential increase in assaults so far in 2025, compared with the same time frame last year. Critics, meanwhile, say that federal officers wearing masks and plain clothes escalates tensions and creates an environment of intimidation. One former ICE official told The Times it sets a dangerous precedent.
The concern for him is just that ordinary members of the public have no way to know if someone is a law enforcement officer or an imposter. If somebody comes up to you with a mask and t-shirt and no badge, he said, why would you think they're exercising a legitimate authority, you know, as opposed to being a violent criminal trying to do you harm?
Critics also argue federal agents aren't operating under any greater threats than local police officers, who are typically required to wear uniforms and often don't wear masks. Mask policies vary by jurisdiction.
California state law doesn't mention masks, but it is more specific on sort of identification. You know, it requires uniformed officers to wear a badge, nameplate, or other device which bears clearly on its face the identification number or name of the officer.
Lawmakers are now discussing adding more requirements. At the state level, California Democrats have introduced a bill that would block any law enforcement officials working in the state from wearing masks. And there are similar efforts underway in Congress. Democratic senators this week introduced a bill that would prevent immigration officers at all levels of government from wearing masks or concealing their identities. Democrats in the House are supporting a similar policy called No Masks for ICE. Before we let you go, some other stories we're following. Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University graduate detained by U.S. immigration authorities for over 100 days, is suing the Trump administration for what he says was false imprisonment. Khalil is seeking $20 million in damages and told the Associated Press he was maliciously prosecuted and falsely labeled an anti-Semite.
This is something I will never forgive. It failed, but still the harm is already there. So unless they feel that there's some sort of accountability for that, they would continue to go unchecked.
Khalil was arrested in March and spent months detained while the administration attempted to deport him, arguing that his activism was against foreign policy interests. Courts eventually ordered his release as immigration proceedings continue. The Department of Homeland Security described his claim as absurd. There was a major upset at Wimbledon yesterday when Amanda Anisimova beat world number one and the heavy favorite, Aryna Sabalenka, to advance to the final on Saturday. She is the first American to advance to a Wimbledon final since Serena Williams in 2019. Anisimova has been open about her struggles with mental health in the past, the tragedy of losing her father at the age of 17, and her break from playing professionally. She reflected on the moment on the court after her win.
To be honest, if you told me I would be in the final of Wimbledon, I would not believe you. at least not this soon, because, I mean, it's been a year turnaround since, you know, coming back and to be in this spot. I mean, it's not easy.
To win the tournament, she'll have to get through Iga Swiatek, who herself was a previous number one player and has won 5 Grand Slams. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the News app right now, stick around for the latest episode of Apple News in Conversation. This week, I talked to New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos on the heels of Jeff Bezos's extravagant Venice wedding about the ultra-wealthy in America and how the wealth gap is bigger than ever.
Take the example of Elon Musk, the richest man in the world. He had about $10 billion 10 years ago. Today, he has more than $400 billion. And in fact, this isn't just an extraordinary growth by modern standards. I spoke to archaeologists about it, who study inequality all the way back to the Neolithic age. And as one of them said to me recently, the people who built the pyramids were living in a less unequal society.
If you're listening in the podcasts app, you can find that episode by searching for Apple News in Conversation. Enjoy your weekend, and I'll be back with the news on Monday.